Hi, this is David Wessel from Brookings. I want to welcome everybody to this webinar on financial disclosure and municipal market dynamics, what the research tells us. This is an experiment of sorts by the Municipal Finance Conference, which is a joint venture of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at Brookings, the Brandeis International Business School's Rosenberg Institute of Global Finance, the Olin Business School of Washington University in St. Louis, and new this year, the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. So we welcome everybody. The drill today is going to be, we're going to start with a presentation by Justin Marlowe, who's at the Evans School of Public Policy and Governance at the University of Washington. Then we're going to have responses from Steve Winterstein, who is at Wilmington Trust, Chief Municipal Fixed Income Strategist, and by Michelle Mark Levine, who's the Deputy Controller for Accountancy in the City of New York. We expect that'll take about 35 minutes or so, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions. The software is a little bit complicated, but not excessively so. If you're everybody's voice is muted now. If you want to ask a question later, and we'll repeat this later, you should see a little on the left side of the webinar control panel, there's a hand with a green stigmata, and if you click on that, that's how you raise your hand. And here in Washington, I'll call on you. I can unmute your line. Or if the audio isn't working for some reason, or you just want to ask a written question, there's the chat feature there. We'll see the chat, and we can do it. So I want to remind people that the Municipal Finance Conference in 2017 is scheduled for July 17th and 18th here at Brookings in Washington. And we are extremely interested in soliciting proposals for papers for the conference on aspects of municipal capital markets or state and local fiscal issues in general. If you're new to the conference, there you can see from our website past papers that have been delivered, and any of the organizers, any of the institutions I mentioned at the beginning would be more than happy to field your questions. I'm particularly pleased that we have, as at this moment, 86 people joining the webinar, which is quite impressive given that we've never done this before. And as far as I can tell, President Trump is not yet one of the people who dialed in. But if that changes, we'll let you know. So at this point, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Justin Marlowe at the University of Washington. And I don't know how to do that, but my colleagues here will do it. And Justin, so you should be able to speak now.
Okay, thank you very much, David. Really a pleasure to join everyone here today. Please let me know if we can't see my screen. But like I said, the real pleasure and an honor to be able to speak on this topic and have the great responses that we're going to have from Steve and Michelle, too. So the main question that we want to deal with here today is, what does the research tell us about how the municipal bond market responds to state and local financial disclosures? Now, to be really clear, right at the outset, when we're talking about disclosure in this context, we're really talking about financial disclosure, that is to say the financial reports, the comprehensive annual financial reports that state and local governments produce usually every year. It's quite different from the types of disclosure that you've heard about around, say, price disclosure or some of the other more recent regulatory and other changes in the municipal bond market. Here we're talking mostly about financial reports. There's been a ton of work in this area. My job here today is really just to give kind of a high-level summary of what we know now and to draw your attention, I hope, to some of the really great research that has been and will continue to be done in this space. We're looking at this question, and we'll talk more about this in a little bit, for a variety of reasons, but there's certainly been a lot of recent regulatory activity in this space. The federal government has had some very visible actions as of late, and this has certainly caused a lot of folks to take notice and ask how this market is structured and how the regulatory space around state and local government financial disclosure is working or is not working and what might be done a little bit differently. And that really brings us to the main focus for what we want to talk about today, which is to look at three very specific, what I'm going to call policy interventions. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but these are all three different types of changes that have been proposed or that could be proposed around changing the way that state and local governments disclose their financial information. The first would be to require compliance with generally accepted accounting principles. And I'll go over in just a little bit what exactly we mean by that. But this is certainly a change that we've seen at many states, encouraging or even mandating that local governments in particular prepare their financial statements according to the generally accepted accounting principles produced by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. There's also been some push to try to minimize the delay, that is to say the what we call disclosure delay, or the time it takes for governments to produce their financial statements, and some steps that can be taken and have been proposed to be taken in that direction. And then also focus on the potential content of financial reports, that is to say what types of specific sorts of financial disclosures might be most useful, might change investor perceptions, and might answer some of the big questions that I know many have around government financial health, state and local government financial condition more broadly. Just to summarize, I think the main takeaway from this right at the outset, one of the big challenges we have here is you'll see again and again and again what these studies reveal is that the bond market does seem to focus on the kinds of disclosures that we're describing here. There does seem to be a market response to all the different types of disclosure improvements and disclosure changes that could happen. The challenge with this, of course, is that we have to ask ourselves this kind of benefit-cost question. What exactly are those benefits, and do those benefits really outweigh the cost for government issuers to produce and to comply with the kinds of changes that they would require? And I'm sure that we'll have a good part of the discussion around that question specifically. So just to briefly go over for anyone who's unfamiliar what the disclosure landscape looks like, it's fair to say that state and local government financial reports are unregulated. And that's to say quite different from the way that the corporate bond market is regulated, where the Securities and Exchange Commission has a direct say in the format and the content and the type of accounting that's used to produce those statements. In the state and local government financial world, there's no direct regulation. A lot of that following from the Tower Amendment of 1975, which deliberately excludes state and local governments from those traditional SEC financial reporting requirements. Now, that said, the SEC does have very broad, in what we may call indirect authority. A lot of that indirect authority is derived from an entity that was created when the Tower Amendment was passed, called the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, the MSRB. And the MSRB is the main regulatory entity, or what we might call quasi-regulatory entity, that regulates municipal bond brokers and dealers. Now, a part of the MSRB's mandate is to make certain that investors have the information they need to make certain that they are getting the investments that they hope for, that when they go out and they buy municipal bonds, that they're not concerned about fraudulent information, that they're well-informed, and that they have the information they need to make investment decisions. And so as a part of that, there's a broad series of what are called continuing disclosure rules that are created by the SEC, created by the MSRB and enforced largely by FINRA, and increasingly enforced by the SEC. And these financial disclosure rules require that the content of financial reports is free of any potential misstatements, omissions of information, material misstatements, anything that might mislead an investor and lead to a material difference in the way an investor might make a decision. And so through this sort of indirect authority, the SEC does certainly have a say on the content and the structure of government financial reports. Most recently, we've seen there have been quite a bit of action in this space. The SEC has actually had, back in 2012, produced a report that got a lot of attention that highlighted a variety of concerns about the nature of disclosure in the municipal bond market, namely the timeliness and the informativeness of those financial reports. And that has led to a variety of recent changes, namely something that many of us are familiar with, what they call the MCDC, the Continuing Disclosure Cooperation Initiative, as well as some really high-profile convictions against governments themselves. The MCDC was targeted at financial institutions, and there were several financial institutions that agreed to fines due to their non-compliance with a lot of these continuing disclosure rules. And then there were actually some recent actions taken against local governments themselves, including the City of Miami, the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey just paid a major fine, again, all related to concerns about continuing disclosure. More recently, as many of you may have heard, Congresswoman Gwen Moore from Milwaukee has introduced a bill that would, in effect, put the onus for complying with these types of disclosure rules on governments themselves. So a big shift potentially in policy and interpretation. And as part of that, that would also mandate some national accounting standards. So we would see a lot more kind of direct regulation of the way that governments prepare their financial reports. So there's really two kinds of schools of thought around this. There's definitely arguments for keeping the status quo. That is to say, to keep this largely unregulated, largely federal government not involved structure. A big one is that state and local governments are extraordinarily complex. There's a lot of them. It's very difficult to come up with a national regulatory regime that could be fairly applied to the more than 85,000 units of government, many of which have bonds outstanding in the marketplace. There's also compliance concerns, which I'm sure we're going to get into here a little bit later, especially for smaller jurisdictions. It can be very difficult for them to have the staff, have the systems in place, to follow GAAP rules or to do some of the other disclosure reforms that we're talking about here. And there is definitely an argument that says that there's a market discipline at work here, that if a government is grossly out of compliance and is not providing the market with the information that investors need, that government will pay a penalty, and that penalty will be enough to encourage the kinds of compliance that some would like to see happen through regulatory means instead. There's also a very strong set of arguments for regulated disclosure. A big one is that it's easier than ever to comply with the kinds of rules that publicly traded companies have to comply with. A big one is the advent of what we call XBRL, or Extensible Business Reporting Language, which is some technology that makes it much easier to produce financial reports on the fly once the system is implemented. It's definitely a movement toward what we might call the democratization of public finance. Entities like OpenGov, Neighborly, which is in effect a crowdfunding platform for local governments, Socrata, BondLink, lots of others where access to government information is now more in demand than ever, and investors and other stakeholders are wondering when and how they can get a hold of really good, solid, comparable financial information from their governments. There's also a little more technical argument to be made here. If you think back to the days when we still had default insurance in the municipal bond market, there wasn't nearly as much concern about the financial condition of local governments because there was always the potential for an insurance policy to make up for any misunderstandings or problems that hadn't been noticed. The municipal bond industry is still there and is gradually coming back, but in the absence of a really robust municipal bond market, a bond insurance program, that we don't get the same kind of commoditizing effect in the municipal bond market. So there's definitely a need for new disclosure to try to fill that gap. So for the rest of this, I just want to focus on the three main interventions that we've talked about and just very briefly go through some of what the evidence suggests at this point. Again, this is not intended to be a comprehensive overview. I've included at the back of these slides, which we'll make available later, a bibliography that lists all of the papers that I'll mention here. For the requiring GAAP compliance, the first one that we talked about, again, you have to keep in mind that local governments and state governments themselves comply to varying degrees with generally accepted accounting principles. These are the national standards that are made by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. By 1996, virtually every state government had, but there's a lot of variation in the way that this plays out at the local level. There are about 15 states where state law actually requires that the local government comply with GAAP. And in roughly 10, there's the exact opposite, where it's largely unregulated. So state law is either silent or leaves it totally up to local governments for how they want to prepare their financial statements. The other 25 are kind of someplace in between. They might follow a statewide chart of accounts that has some connection to GAAP as created by the GASB. There might be some other alternative. And so these states are someplace in between. So when we talk about the GAAP and GAAP regulation, it's really a complicated picture because different states treat this issue in very different ways. Now, that said, the arguments in favor of going to GAAP compliance are obviously that it makes one government comparable to the next, creates much better comparability from one government to the next, and that can, in some cases, reduce emphasis on things like cash basis budgeting and cash basis financial reporting, which I know has been a real point of emphasis among a lot of folks who are trying to bring precisely these kinds of reforms for better transparency and planning in local government and to some degree in state governments as well. And of course, the big disadvantage, and we'll hear this again and again, is the implementation cost. It's very costly to produce these systems and maintain them, especially if you're a smallish local government. So what does the research tell us so far? Well, we know that in states where GAAP is required, governments tend to borrow at an average of about 15 to 25 basis points less than in states where GAAP is not required. So in other words, there is a benefit or an added advantage to being in a GAAP-regulated state vis-a-vis the bond market. We also know that, and again, back in the day, and I think some of this still applies, that there was this kind of substitution effect, that if you were a local government in a non-regulated state, you had the option to buy bond insurance, and that would bring about basically the same effect as better quality disclosure. So it would be interesting to see how that has shaken out in the aftermath of the bond insurance industry. We also know that for governments that are that have quite a bit of debt, there's not necessarily the same benefits to disclosures. But if you are an entity that does not find itself in the municipal bond market often, there are some benefits, some sizable benefits, in fact, in terms of better borrowing costs for doing additional disclosures. So in other words, there's an incentive for local governments that aren't in the market often to kind of fill in the gaps that investors might want to know about them by providing additional financial disclosures. We also know that there's a lot of attention paid to what we call accrual measures. I'm happy to go into this in some detail. There have been some changes as of late to GAAP itself that have required governments that follow GAAP to produce government-wide accrual basis financial statements. And there were some questions initially about whether investors would really respond to this. We know that the bond rating agencies look carefully at this. In fact, we've seen that evidence play out many different times. And yet, we also know from some more recent survey evidence that buy-side analysts in the bond market still depend pretty heavily on the sort of old-style GAAP. So we have variation here in the way that GAAP plays out in the market and even within the different kinds of GAAP that are followed or not followed by investors. So the second big intervention that we can talk about is to improve disclosure timeliness. And in this case, we need to just to give a sense of the landscape. You know, on average, there have been some studies that have shown that state and local governments are typically producing their financial statements about 180 days after the fiscal close. And, of course, in the corporate market, this would be unthinkable. There's very rare would you see a publicly traded company have that kind of lag in its financial disclosure. But there's also some good reasons why this happens in governments, namely that government financial statements are quite complex to prepare. So when we talk about improving this, is there a way to shorten that 180 days? There's a couple things that can and have been done. One is to actually mandate by a legislator, by statute, that you have to produce your financial statements by some date certain, 60 days, 90 days, whatever the time frame is. There's actually been some movement toward producing periodic unaudited reports at the quarterly level, perhaps, or at the quarterly interval, and also some emphasis on maybe simplifying or streamlining the content of financial reports to make them that much easier to get out sooner. And so, of course, in this case, when you have faster disclosure, it reduces uncertainty. If you're an analyst looking at a government's bonds, information that's 180 days old is not nearly as useful if you care about recent decisions, recent policy decisions, recent budgeting decisions. Of course, the disadvantage, again, is compliance. It's very difficult to get these statements out, and to get them out at more frequent intervals might make it even more difficult. So what do we know from the research? Well, certainly there's been a lot of work that has shown that bond analysts tend to discount the value of what we might call stale financial information, or information that's more than, say, 90 days old. We also know that even more recently, the evidence from analysts, similar to what we were just talking about, have shown that some analysts go as far as to say that disclosure delay can actually suggest some much bigger problems, maybe potential problems with internal controls, some management weaknesses, all kinds of things that might be kind of the underlying reason why financial statements are not getting out on time. We also know that from some more recent work that there's actually a pretty direct relationship between delay. So for every 100 days of audit delay, a typical bond issue is going to pay about 6 basis points extra at the local level. Now, again, we can debate the substance of that and whether the economic effects of 6 basis points are a big deal. Certainly for larger issuers, you can make the case that that does have real economic impact. But what's the value of reducing to, say, 50 days or 30 days? And then also some more recent work, we've shown that there is a benefit to doing periodic unaudited quarterly reports. reports. In some states, public hospitals, for example, are required to produce periodic financial reports. And we find that when they do that, they tend to borrow at lower rates, all things up, everything else held constant. And so the third, then, intervention, so to speak, is to talk about how the market responds to specific kinds of disclosures. Do investors care about specific pieces of information, like pensions, other post-employment benefit liabilities, internal control weaknesses, all kinds of other things that we have heard anecdotally that investors care a lot about? But if is there a way to think about calibrating the content of reports? So is it possible for regulators to streamline or set up a regime, a reporting regime that speaks most directly to the information that investors most want without being too onerous on the compliance side? Obviously, it's a difficult balance. The need to be thorough and to be transparent. There's an argument, of course, that says that government transparency is always a good thing. It's good policy, it's good ethics, it's good from an accountability standpoint, and therefore we should be as inclusive as possible. There's another perspective, of course, that says that unless there's some real economic value, that that's a difficult sell for governments in a world where budgets are tight and where there aren't necessarily the resources to do these kinds of things. And for that reason, that added complexity may not necessarily play out quite the way that governments might like it to. So what do we know on this so far? Well, we know that unfunded pension liabilities, for example, are showing up routinely in credit ratings in particular. The ratings agencies have looked at this carefully. Same with what we call OPEB, other post-employment benefit liabilities. We also know that governments that have large have large and unfunded what we call ARC, or annual required contribution to their pension funds, are borrowing. And that there are borrowing at slightly higher rates, that is. And we also know that certain types of disclosures around things like infrastructure, what we call the modified approach to infrastructure reporting, has also reduced the analyst uncertainty, has also reduced price dispersions in the secondary market by about 15%. Or in other words, when there's different kinds of information about how governments are maintaining their infrastructure, that seems to also play out in the market in a positive way for issuers. One of the things that we've also seen more recently is that governments that have disclosed what we call material weaknesses on their internal controls, that is to say concerns about their systems that they use to produce their financial reports or to maintain their assets, if you have a known material weakness in your internal controls, that also feeds back in higher borrowing costs. So all these things, again, tell us that there's definitely a material effect. There's a statistically significant economic effect to disclosing certain dimensions of your financial condition. And the question of what are the right conditions, what's the right mix, what's the right balance is something that we continue to grapple with when we think about a regulatory change. The last thing I want to mention is where we need to know more, and there might be some good insights out there today on exactly this question. Research has dealt with lots of questions, but has left a few, for the most part, unanswered. A big one is, of course, in research, when we publish this stuff, one of the questions often is, well, what are we not finding? Obviously, as a professor, if you're trying to publish a paper and you find that some aspect of disclosure matters to bond investors, that's a publishable finding. The question is, well, what happens if you find that something does not matter to investors? And so there's definitely a bias against what we might call non-findings. I know that there's some academics on the phone. I'd be curious to hear if any of them would like to share any of their views on what we're not finding and what that tells us about potential regulatory changes. Very little good work on what it actually costs to implement this stuff. Certainly the folks at the Governmental Accounting Standards Board would tell you that they hear all the time about how difficult and expensive it is to comply with their standards, but there's been very little work that actually tries to quantify that in terms of financial costs, staff time, opportunity costs, very little work on that. I think we need to know a lot more. Definitely more to be learned on the role of statewide bodies. You think about entities like the North Carolina Local Government Commission, the Texas Bond Review Board, some of these state-level entities that directly have the kind of say in local government financial reporting that we're describing here. Very little work that's shown what difference they make compared to states that don't necessarily have that function. We need to know a lot more about the role of budgeting. Obviously, in this world, we've talked a lot about financial reporting, which is very important, but of course the budget is really where the action is when we talk about fiscal policy and resource allocation questions for state and local governments. And so there's a lot more work needs to be known on whether budget institutions matter, and transparency around the budget makes a difference. And then finally, lots of work really need to be done on understanding, again, the technological changes that are in play here, the benefits and costs and implementation challenges related to things like XBRL. Lots of jurisdictions experimenting with this, considering these changes, and a lot more work need to be done to figure exactly what that means. So again, the value of disclosure as a democratic principle, what's the value of that? Is that an obligation? And can we and should we think of these things in terms of financial costs as well? So the last thing, again, as mentioned, I have a variety of papers cited here. If you're curious, I encourage you to take a look at all this work. And with that, I'd be happy to turn it back over and open up the conversation.
Justin, thank you very much for that well-organized and clear presentation. I should have noted at the beginning that the whole thing is being recorded, so you can relive Justin Marlowe's greatest hits. And also, Justin will send us the slides. We'll put them on the website as well. I'm now going to turn the mic over to Michelle and ask her to – we'd ask Michelle and Steve to speak for 7 to 10 minutes, just to give your perspective, one from the issuer perspective and one from the investor perspective. So, Michelle, Carrie's going to unmute your line, and you're on.
Excellent. Thank you. First, I want to thank you for inviting me to participate in this, firstly because I have the great pleasure of hearing Justin's presentation and learning more about what actually has been researched and what has been shown by it. Just to give folks a little bit of background about me and about New York City, I'm the Deputy Comptroller and the Chief Accountant for the City of New York. I am appointed by the city's elected comptroller, Scott Stringer. In New York City, similar to New York State, there is an independently elected mayor or governor and an independently elected comptroller. So it's a real system of checks and balances. It also means that there's a separation to a strange degree between accounting and budgeting. Budgeting is an executive function, meaning the mayor here in New York City is responsible for proposing the budget to the city council and for the oversight of the budget, but the accounting and financial reporting is primarily a responsibility of the comptroller's office. I want to start by saying that I am only speaking personally. I do not speak for Scott Stringer, for the Office of the Comptroller, for the City of New York, or anyone else, and that's important because I am going to be expressing some opinions, and you need to know they're mine. New York City, not surprisingly, is big. We have an annual operating budget of about $87 billion, 287, roughly, 1,000 employees, 120 of whom are teachers, 64,000 of whom are uniform employees, police officers, firefighters, corrections officers, sanitation folks. We issue anywhere between $8 and $12 billion annually of debt, both new money and refinancing, and that is between both the city's general obligation and some related issuers, including the city's Municipal Water Finance Authority, which finances improvements to the city's water and sewer system, and also the Transitional Finance Authority, which uses personal income tax-backed bonds for the city's general capital program and also New York State education grant-backed bonds to finance schools and related improvements. We are required by the city's charter to issue our CAFR, our Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, which includes our GAAP financial statements and an independent auditor's report thereon, by October 31st for our June 30th year-end, so 4 months. And interestingly, I have found that that is a shorter period of time than many of my colleagues in governments of various sources. In fact, I was recently at a GFOA meeting where one of my colleagues from another smaller but not tiny government said, how do you do it? How do you get it out in 4 months? And of course, I'm always thinking, how could it take us 4 months when these huge international corporations stretched all over the world are able to get their financial statements out in a month, or certainly to release earnings reports sometimes in just 2 weeks after the end of a period? Citi has reported and, in fact, budgeted on a GAAP basis since the time of the Citi's fiscal crisis in the 1970s, and I think that that has been a tremendous benefit to the Citi, giving us an external yardstick that keeps us from moving the finish line as we race towards fiscal health, and it certainly has gone a long way to increase the stature of the Citi in the bond markets. We were, as some old folks like me may recall, effectively bankrupt in the mid-70s. We have been very successful having that external yardstick, and I am a big supporter of it, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why I think some of the arguments against using GAAP are, in my view, not as strong as they might appear. First, I want to say, if you think about it philosophically, right, publicly traded corporations whose stockholders and creditors choose to finance those entities are guaranteed GAAP-based financial statements. Not sure conceptually why taxpayers who finance, in fact, involuntarily shouldn't be entitled to a similar level of complete financial disclosures with relative consistency. As Justin pointed out, however, governments are necessarily complex, and therefore financial reporting under GAAP is complex and costly, because, frankly, governments operate in a complex and costly world. That's especially true for larger governments that have a broader scope of operations and larger financing transactions. But it really applies to smaller governments, too, because with complex financial instruments, the banks and underwriters are able to entice, encourage governments of various sizes to get involved in complex transactions. So that complexity is not limited to the large governments. There's always a good deal of pushback with regard to major changes in governmental financial reporting requirements. And while there certainly are high costs to compliance, I would say that there's also a great deal of resistance to change. And Justin, you mentioned that there's really no good data on the costs of implementation. I would take a little bit of exception to that. GASB does actually collect cost information from governments that participate in field tests of their new standards, and while they always show a wide range of reported time and costs for implementation, they generally are lower than what I hear some of the critics of proposed changes spouting as costs, et cetera. I think that it's pretty important to recognize that even if smaller governments are required to do complex financial reporting, it's very likely that the economics will be such that there will be services available from either local or national firms that are looking to essentially capitalize on the opportunity that's presented by complex regulations. Certainly, you know, the smallest small business still has to comply with very complex labor and taxation rules relating to pension and compensation.
You can hear it in the background, right? I mean, I'm dialed in.
I'm sorry? Okay, I'm going to continue. I hope that doesn't mean that people are having trouble hearing me. certainly we are familiar with ADP and paychecks and other services that have been established to deal with the complexity for a very large number of organizations. And I'm already seeing on regional basis that there are firms, some organizations that were formerly auditors for small state and local government entities that have switched over essentially to the consulting and financial statement preparation operation. And I think that that is likely to grow to the extent that more governments and smaller, less sophisticated governments are required to do more sophisticated financial reporting. I don't think that this is going to end up doubling the administrative costs of government. Now, of course, I don't have any research to support that, so I think that the one question that we might want to add to the list of future reporting at research to be done is whether or not the market forces can provide certain services, and I think with technology we're likely to see that. I will say, however, Government Finance Officers Association does recognize that for small governments, they don't think that the costs are matched by the benefits, and they have, in fact, been advocating for an alternative but somewhat standardized reporting measure for smaller governments. So there is the prospect that there can be some distinctions between large government and small government reporting and still have the benefit of some standardization. SEC regulation, I'm going to start with an anecdote, which is that I took on my current position just about 3 years ago, and on entering it, having been with the city for a long time in another capacity, I had a couple of areas where I was aware I didn't know everything. There were some things that I had not an alarming concern about, but the sense that I needed to learn more about. Fairly early on in my tenure, I went to a Government Finance Officers Association conference, at which an SEC enforcement attorney was the primary speaker for a session. Basically, he analogized the culpability of government officials who sign off on bond issuance documents without personal due diligence to that of folks who drive with their eyes closed. A little bit alarming, given that they have been, as you heard from Justin, now looking to prosecute both governments, and in some cases individual government officials. And I have to admit that that motivated me to investigate a little more thoroughly one area that I had some concerns about, and did result in some changes to the way the city was making certain financial statement reporting and disclosures. So I guess on that anecdotal basis, I would say there probably is some benefit to having the SEC or other significant law enforcement involved in the disclosure for governments or anyone else who's issuing financial statements on which folks will be relying to purchase debt or make other financial investments.
Great. Can I suggest we stop here for a minute and turn the mic over to Steve, and if you want to come back later with additional comments, is that all right?
That's fine. I'm sorry.
Good. That's all right. Steve?
Yes.
Can you unmute your phone? Good. Great. We can hear you.
Oh, terrific. Thanks, David. Like Michelle, I just have a quick disclaimer. I am the Chief Municipal Strategist and Director of Research of Municipal Fixed Income at Wilmington Trust, and any of my comments, observations, or otherwise are my own. Do not represent those of Wilmington Trust or any professional association with which I am affiliated. I in looking over the news in the last couple of days, and I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach to this this issue of disclosure, and then I want to throw a question or two back at Justin. Looking at the news over the last several days or last couple of weeks, I know the DTC recently announced a venture with IBM Watson with blockchain to handle all their credit default swaps, $11 trillion worth of credit default swaps, and they're going to launch that in early 2018. And just, I guess it was yesterday, Reuters reported that NASDAQ successfully completed a blockchain test to run proxy voting on a stock exchange in Europe, and that they plan to take that technology and apply it elsewhere. So what is my point in all this? Well, you know, from a buy-side perspective, disclosure is absolutely essential, and being able to access the correct financial statements, documents, the continuing disclosure, any updates on a timely basis and with ease is also critical for our business to make quick decisions and to make informed decisions. You know, my hat goes off to the MSRB, and over the last 10 years or so, the progress that we've made with EMMA is absolutely phenomenal, and the efforts there are widely recognized and appreciated by the municipal market, I know particularly by institutional market participants. However, I think there's much work to be done. Yesterday, several professional organizations in public finance, the Bond Dealers of America, GFOA, and so forth, there were five or six of them, that penned a letter to the MSRB, and that letter included a list of things that we think that those organizations think the MSRB could do to make access to information much more readily available, and to improve things like searching for issuers, the kinds of documents that we're specifically looking for. And just to dimension that for everyone, you know, the statistics they differ depending on your source. But when you look at when you look at the number of municipalities, state and local governments, the conduit issuers, and so forth out there, we've seen numbers as high as 80,000. Whether or not that's the right number is up for debate. But about, I think, 60 to 65,000 of those issuers come to market in the form of issuing tax-exempt municipal bonds. So the problem, of course, as Michelle was saying, and I think Justin mentioned, it is one of an extraordinarily fragmented market. And so I think in order to tackle this problem, we need to think of it as a big data problem from the buy side. So we have the issues of disclosure that Justin presented, and we have the perspective of an issuer that Michelle just went through. But from a buy side analyst or a buy side portfolio manager or strategist, I'm dealing with roughly 2,000 CUSIPs, roughly 65,000 obligors in the marketplace, and what I'm trying to do is make sense of all of this. And there's one repository where I go to right now, today, to find my disclosure documents, and that's the MSRB's EMMA website. And honestly, while it has made huge strides in offering that information to us, there's still a lot to work on. Things like being able to search an obligor, things like smart search. When I go into, for example, the city of New York, it can be city of NY, it can be New York City, it can be the city of New York, it can just be New York, New York. And so there are so many different ways that this documentation and all these disclosures are entered into EMMA under all the various reporting systems, and how they're linked together by obligor and by conduit issuer and so on and so forth. What I think is as critical as anything is for the MSRB to undertake an overhaul, or maybe not an overhaul, but an improvement of their EMMA website, so that I can, as a buyer, as an investor, or as a person who's representing investors, so that I can go in and I can find exactly what I'm looking for on a timely basis, and then I can apply it to the specific issue that I'm trying to clarify on the buy side. So that's I think as important. And let me put it another way. While all the work that Justin is doing is wonderful work, and we're all about transparency. I think that's what the market wants, transparency. And continuing disclosure, as Justin suggests, his work suggests, improves the cost of borrowing and so forth. But if we get to a point where all it is a complete stack of PDF files, where I can't take that information and on a timely basis deploy it to make informed decisions on the fly, then I'm not so sure that escalating that information or increasing the amount of regulation and the amount of disclosure does me a whole lot of good in making those decisions on a timely basis. So with that, and those are just a few of my observations as a buy side research person. I think one question that I would throw back to Justin and to Michelle is. The argument about the smaller issuer being encumbered with having to if they are required to file according to GAAP and so on and so forth, do either of you or both of you think that a bifurcated market in terms of a regulatory environment or a regulatory regime, do you think that a bifurcated market would make sense so that larger issuers are subject to maybe more stringent standards, and that smaller, less frequent to market issuers have maybe a more relaxed required reporting scheme?
Thanks. What Carrie's going to do now is, my colleague Carrie Granis is going to unmute the panelists, Michelle, if you're automatically unmuted, and Justin. If you're a participant and you have a question, there are two ways to ask it. One is on your control panel, you can touch that hand with a green stigmata on it, and we can call on you. Or if you want to text a message, and a number of people have texted some messages in the chat function, we'll pose them. So Justin and Michelle and Steve, I just want to mention a couple of the questions that have come in already. One is, let's see here. Justin, let me just start with a couple of the factual ones. Do we know what percentage of states make interim quarterly financials issuances similar to corporates or non-state issuers like power authorities? And also from the same guy, Stevens McAleer, how many municipal issuers do things like do annual investor days or have bond relation programs with professional investor relations people? So, Justin, why don't we start with you on those questions or Steve's, and then we'll go to the other panelists.
Yeah, sure. This is Justin. I'd be happy to start that, and I'm sure there's some other views on that. On the first question about states requiring or encouraging interim disclosures, I'm most familiar with, as I mentioned in the presentation, most familiar with hospital districts. And the paper that I mentioned specifically looked at hospital districts in California, which is a state that does require that. And then a few others, although I think, if I recall from that research, it's something like 20% or thereabouts of nonprofit hospital districts, tax-exempt hospital districts, about 20% by volume of outstanding bonds are subject to that requirement of quarterly interim reports. I know that there is an analog in the public power sector and a couple other more more enterprise or business type sectors. I can imagine, I don't know for sure, I can guess that it's probably about the same kind of level of coverage. So those jurisdictions that are subject to that requirement are definitely the exception rather than the norm, but they're also not complete outliers either. So there's definitely some more to be learned there. On the second question about investor relations, that's actually the very last bullet point on that. I think I actually glossed over that in the presentation itself. That's actually a really, really interesting question. I know there are several jurisdictions that have taken to doing that. They all tend to be really larger ones. I know when Colin McNaught was running Treasury in Massachusetts, he was doing a lot of that kind of investor outreach. Here, I'm in Seattle at the University of Washington. The Port of Seattle has been a real pioneer in that. They actually do a roadshow. They go out and they talk to investors, and they also bring investors here locally and have presentations and make sure that other issuers are also visible, the state of Washington, the University of Washington. And anecdotally, I know from talking to the folks at the Port and folks at the state treasurer's office and elsewhere that has provided some real benefits. It's an opportunity to get into some more nuanced questions and to help buyers really understand the unique characteristics of their story in any given year. So that, I think we're seeing more of that. I think we'll see more of that. At the moment, I don't know of any systematic empirical research that looks at the effect of those kinds of outreach efforts, though.
And what about Steve's question about, is there some merit in bifurcating the market?
Yeah, also a very good question. I can speak, I'll limit my comments on that mostly to what the research tells us, and I think what the research there tells us, whether it's on disclosure or the effects of things like size of a jurisdiction or the frequency with which your jurisdiction is in the bond market, what all that research tells us is that there is, in fact, a bifurcated market. There's a kind of little gap, big gap effect to little governments, a large government kind of an effect, and they really are treated very differently. And a lot of it is around exactly this question of availability of financial information, helping investors to sort of fill in the gaps in the story between, say, 3 years ago when that small school district was in the bond market. And so there is something to be said there. I think, again, I don't know if anyone has looked at that question specifically in the context of what we've talked about here today, but everything else we know about the way the market works suggests that there is a clear distinction there, and one that there might be some value in it having a different kind of a financial disclosure regime.
This is Michelle.
Great. Please, go ahead.
With regard to bifurcated markets,
we're getting a little bit of feedback, so just be careful when you speak.
Okay. I just wanted to add that one consideration in terms of bifurcation may be the presence of complex transactions and or situations. So a small government that was involved in derivatives trading before that was widely understood, or that has its own pension obligations, such as New York City does, even if you're a smaller government, the complexity of your operations might be appropriate in dictating the complexity, frankly, of your disclosures and reporting. So I wouldn't want to tag it only to size or frequency of issue, because I think you risk losing some important information.
Thank you. So Ben Watkins posed a couple of questions, which I'm going to read, and then, Rich, I'll call on you. Has any research been done to determine if issuers using websites for disclosure or investor relations have lowered their borrowing costs? I think you kind of dealt with that already. Do we know anything about the cost to dealers and issuers in responding to the SEC's MCDC initiative, and did it serve really to improve the information available to analysts and investors? And similarly, has the EMMA improved disclosure, improved the liquidity and efficiency of bond trading in the muni market? So two questions. One is, do we know that there's a favorable, what do we get from the SEC's MCDC initiative? And secondly, has EMMA improved disclosure enough, and has it helped improve liquidity? Steve, do you have a view on that? And then I'll turn to Justin.
I do. In terms of MCDC, I'm not sure in terms of the cost, but I would like to make a point that there's a cottage industry that is developed, and there are certain vendors out there that offer for a very reasonable cost that offer services of basically looking for all the issuer's misses and then making sure that they have all their disclosures and then testing on an ongoing basis to make sure that their disclosures are completely up to date and so forth. So one of the things that I think has come out of all of this is that there are providers out there of services at a very reasonable cost, from what I'm seeing, that can be actually put into the cost of the deal, if you will, of the new issue, without increasing the borrowing cost materially. These are nominal fees that these providers of this service charge, and it's something that I think was born out of MCDC. So if there was something positive out of that, I think that's one thing. In terms of the efficiency of trading, certainly it's improved liquidity. How much is a very difficult question to answer, because it's extremely difficult to tease out cause and effect. But I can say, you know, if I go back 25 years, when we actually had to call the issuer to get financials, and it was a real treasure hunt to try to get any kind of disclosure. And I'm not talking about issuers like New York City. I'm talking about the more less frequent to market, smaller issuers. It was a chore that most of the analyst's job was collection of data rather than analyzing data. That certainly has changed over the last 10 years. And to Ben's point, you know, or the question, has it provided liquidity? I think so. I'm not sure you can measure exactly how much, but it has allowed us to go to one repository and find financial information that's important in our decision-making process, whether it's at the new issue or in the secondary market. My only point in my discussion early on was that while the MSRB has done fantastic work, there's much work to be done. And I think that ultimately, creating a more searchable database, a relational database that can get me to the piece of information that I'm looking for very quickly, adds to that liquidity in the marketplace.
Thanks. Kirsten, do you have any view on either the EMMA or MCDC?
Yeah, just a couple quick points. Thanks, Ben, for the question. And on the question about the MCDC, I had done a LinkedIn post, a quick little blog post several months ago now on that question. That was really just trying to compare the differences in pricing for jurisdictions that had been called out, so to speak, in the MCDC, or had settled as part of the MCDC, compared to very comparable jurisdictions that had not, and found that at that moment, at that very sort of snapshot in time, very crude analysis, that there did not seem to be any real significant differences in secondary market pricing between those two types of jurisdictions. At the same time, the whole point of that analysis was to say we need to do a lot more here. It's still relatively early. It's going to take time to be able to see how that initiative has fed back into the market. I'm not for or against it. We're just trying to study what has happened, and the very early initial evidence suggests that it has not had a real substantial effect. On the question of the overall implications of EMMA, that's a whole body of research that I didn't really touch on here, but I'm happy to follow up with anyone offline who's curious. There's been extensive work done on this, a seminal paper by Eric Seary at Babson College that looked at this on behalf of the MSRB, in fact. Paul Schultz at Notre Dame, lots of good work that has looked at exactly this question around liquidity, price volatility, a lot of the different kinds of market efficiency measures that we care about, and has generally found, as Steve had mentioned, that there have been improvements, whether they are what we had hoped for or whether they're having real economic implications for buyers and for issuers is kind of a separate question, but I think all the evidence suggests that there have been improvements in things like liquidity and price volatility, in large part just because of the transparency that EMMA has brought to the market.
Thanks. Rich Reifel, I'm unmuting your line, so you're on.
Yeah, I was curious if anyone expects that there might be a greater move toward homogenizing local credits via state pool issuers or state bond banks. with the thought being that local issuers could provide short-form disclosure up to a state entity. The state entity, of course, would understand the risk best, and then the state entity could offer, as is done in some states, of course, could offer one homogeneous credit to the market. So if that might be a better market-based way to skin the cat as opposed to some sort of broader regulatory reform.
Thanks. I want to note that we heard from the MSRB, which wants you all to be aware that they're actively soliciting input as they try and improve the visibility of the EMMA website and is looking to enhance the EMMA with features that support market transparency, including a new issue calendar, third-party yield curves, and potentially pre-trade price data. There's a contact which we sent you on the old chat function, Barbara Voutet, and her email at MSRB if you want to contribute. Does anybody want to respond, either any of the people on the panel or on the call general, to Rich's point or any other point? If you're a panelist, you have to raise your hand with that little green thing. What? If you're not a panelist, you're just a participant. If not, there is another question, which is a little bit long, but I'm going to read it. It's from Andrew Glassberg, who says that during his service on a small suburban city council in the St. Louis area, the advisor for the defined benefit pension fund argued that rather than focusing on anticipated gross rate of return, that they should instead focus on the anticipated return minus the anticipated increases in compensation. If we anticipated the compensation would increase very slowly, then the anticipated rate of return on the investments might be satisfactory, even if that was at a lower rate of return. He says, I'm not familiar with the GASPI rules, but is there any evidence that this issue is taken into account by the buyers in the bond market? Michelle or Steve, do you have that? Do you know anything to respond to that?
Sure. Please, actually, my understanding is that the estimate of future salary increases is a component of the actuarial calculations that are done. So if anyone wants to assess those, they should be available from the actuary, which is not generally open to the public, but certainly for anyone in the government, or you could make that request of the government to tell you the assumptions that are built in and decide if you think that those are valid assumptions. But they are not something that you need to sort of factor in independent from that actuarial assumption, that actuarial calculation.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that, David.
Okay. I'm just looking here to see if there's any questions that have come in on the chat that have gone unresponded to. I don't see any. If anybody is on the call and wants to ask a question, if you push that little, either send me a chat or raise your hand with that hand with the green line through it, we'll recognize you. If not, I'm going to ask Justin if he wants to say anything to sum up, and we can go back to work. Somebody asks, what about the potential for XBRL? Oh, okay. Does anybody have a view on the XBRL? And I have two questions that go to the audience.
I can speak to XBRL just real briefly, David. I don't know if certainly someone like Michelle would is grappling with those issues a little bit more. But yeah, XBRL is an interesting possibility, and I know there's some work being done. We're involved in a project here in Washington State that's funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that's looking at some of those kinds of questions, whether there is a sort of an XBRL solution to some of these challenges, which would require that you, as a local government, have a particular kind of ERP system and some other technology in place to allow that. That's certainly XBRL is certainly the standard in the corporate world, and there's lots of unique challenges to making it work in government. But that's, that's technology and applications that are becoming more and more accessible and becoming a little bit more affordable. And there might be something there for governments going forward.
This is Michelle.
Kate Long. Oh, go ahead, Michelle.
Just quickly, we are just starting to look at XBRL for New York City. I think that the taxonomy that is available is not necessarily quite ready for prime time, at least as far as I understand from the tech folks who are looking at it. I do think that it has the possibility of really being useful, certainly in a repository situation. As of right now, I think it really is not in widespread enough use for folks to do much useful research based on it. But I do think that it is definitely going to happen. There's been a lot of discussion about whether that should be required by the SEC or I guess through the NSRB, whether or not that should be required of governments. There hasn't been a lot of support for it yet that I'm aware of.
Thanks. Kate Long, we're going to unmute your line. You had a question? Kate?
We lost her, but I have her question.
We have her question.
Any chance that MSRB would include requirement of disclosure of material events about derivatives in continuing disclosure?
The question was, is there any chance that the MSRB would include requirement of disclosure of material events about derivatives in continuing disclosure? Sounds to me like no one knows the answer.
I don't know that they're not included currently.
Okay. Mike Belsky, you had your hand up, but it went away. I'm going to ask Kerry. Is he still there? I'm just going to ask Kerry to unmute your line, and if you have something to say, speak, and if not.
I'm on.
Oh, good. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So I just had an observation in past work I've done analytically is that in some cases on EMMA, and this goes to Steve's point about, you know, how can you take data out of financial statements on a timely basis, you know, notwithstanding that some of them are late, and act on it. And some financial advisors are just exemplary in the work they do. They have these updates that mirror the official statement with data, and it's very easy to access. And so one thought I had is perhaps, you know, a less ideal solution is having the GFOA kind of come up with some sort of model secondary disclosure report. But even better, now that MSRB regulates municipal advisors, perhaps there could be a look at, you know, a minimum sort of update that goes into the secondary market disclosure reports.
There's a question asking about how do we determine who the accountable party is for the disclosure? Is it the issuer, or is it the bank or other intermediary?
It would be from a regulatory standpoint, it would have to be the intermediary.
Mm-hmm. Because of the Tower Amendment, which prevents them from regulating the issuer?
Right, and it's not really a question, it's just an observation. I mean, I've seen on utilities and hospitals, some financial advisors just do a really good job with secondary market disclosure reports where they have all the key metrics organized as if they were just updating the official statement, and it really makes the job of an analyst a lot easier to make timely decisions. And so, you know, is there a way that we could move towards that model either through regulation or just through best practices?
I thought the tone of the research you reported is that to the issuer, there are some benefits in terms of paying less to borrow if you're at the better disclosure end of the spectrum. Did I misread what you said? Is that correct?
No, I mean, I would think this would help.
So if you're the issuer, whether or not you have a good financial advisor, you're suggesting that the research suggests that it may be to your benefit to do better disclosure, although you have to weigh, as you pointed out, 6 basis points sounds good if you have a big issue, but you don't know how much it's going to cost to actually do it.
Right.
Unless there are, I'm a firm, oh, Carol Clarkin, can you unmute her in her line? Carol?
I just had a really, can you guys hear me?
We can.
Okay. I just had a really quick question to get us back to the issue of GAAP, where we started, GAAP. And I guess my overriding question is, I understand its usefulness in financial reports. Coming out of New York City, I also understood its usefulness in budgeting. But it seems to me in the looks I've had at states, there is such a discrepancy between the way budgeting is done on a cash basis and GAAP reporting that nobody wants to face the fact that what appears in GAAP in CAFRs is not what really happens.
Carol, this
does,
is
that does that matter to anybody except me?
Michelle?
Carol, hi. It's Michelle Levine. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Michelle.
What is in financial statements is on a GAAP basis if you have GAAP financial statements. There is a budgetary basis comparison statement that's required that does go back to the cash basis or whatever basis the government borrows on. But even for those who don't budget on a GAAP basis, the fund financial statements are on a GAAP basis. So it should allow a little bit of comparison, if you will, the way we have it in New York City where you can just look at the budget. Here you could look at the GAAP fund financial statements to get a similar sense. I will say, however, GASB is in the process of what they're calling a reporting model reexamination project, and there is currently an invitation to comment out in which they are seeking feedback on a couple of different alternatives for that fund reporting, which would change the way fund reporting is done now, including, Carol, what we would be measured against on a GAAP basis for New York City and for any others who budget on a GAAP basis. So I would point anybody who's interested in this to GASB's website to take a look at that due process document and to provide them feedback.
Yeah, thank you, because to me this gets back to the whole question that somebody raised about, it might have been Justin at the beginning, but how does this reporting actually help us in our ability to make decisions? And I have found that the manipulation of cash in budgeting makes it really difficult to come to the conclusion that the reporting per se is terribly helpful in helping you make intelligent decisions, because it's all after the fact. If that makes any sense.
Mark Jaffe writes in, apparently he can't make a comment by audio. He said he wanted to offer the following. An XBRL implementation addresses Steve's call for a relational database on EMMA. If we have a format that allows issuers to submit their data in discrete fields rather than as a PDF, site users would be able to find the exact information that they need. Anybody else?
This is Steve.
Yes,
Steve. I completely agree with that, and I personally, you know, in this day and age, would love to see a web portal where we can actually see issuers or the underwriters or the MAs actually go in and load that data, upload that data to EMMA in a field format that can be then sorted and organized exactly as Mark said. I think that's exactly the right answer.
Great. Well, with that, I want to thank Justin, Michelle, and Steve for their competing. Mark Jaffe, that was Steve Winterstein speaking. I want to thank you all for participating. I want to thank the 94 people who weren't organizers of the call who dialed in. As I said, we'll put on our website, it'll be on the Hutchins Center website, the the audio of the thing and the slides and everything. And my email address is dwessel, W-E-S-S-E-L, at brookings.edu. And if you have any questions or suggestions about any of this, we'd be happy to entertain them. And I want to repeat that we're really interested in soliciting papers with academic rigor and quality that have policy implications for the July conference. So if you have an idea or you just want to choose something over, let me know. And either I or Dan Bergstresser, Rich Reifel, Mike Belsky, Louise Shane, or all my colleagues on this project will respond. So with that, thank you very much. And I want to thank my colleagues, Kerry Granis and Lilia Cherchari, for finding the software and making it work reasonably smoothly. I think we got a lot of people involved in the conversation at very low cost, and that's a good thing. So thank you all, and have a good and prosperous new year.